After passing through several disks, the Kamehameha headed into open space. We traveled for 9 days before we finally received our briefing on what our next mission would be. Captain McKay led our platoon into an auditorium for the session. I did not recognize the Navy captain who conducted the briefing. A short, slender man whose red hair and ruddy skin contrasted sharply with his gleaming white uniform, the officer was undoubtedly part of Thurston's new regime.
"Now listen up, sea soldiers, and maybe we can teach you something new today."
The captain switched on a holographic projector. The translucent image of a planet appeared on a screen above his head. The planet was shown in 3D and seemed to bulge out of the screen as it rotated.
"Our subject today is real estate and how to protect your land against squatters. The Unified Authority owns the land. The Unified Authority decides who uses the land. When anybody steps on land without the express consent of the Unified Authority, they are squatters and trespassers. Do you understand me, sea soldiers?"
"Sir, yes, sir!"
"The planet you see twirling above my head is currently known as Little Man. The reason I say currently known is because the planet has not been colonized. When Little Man is officially settled, the Senate will rename it. But I am sure you all knew that, gentlemen."
"Sir, yes, sir!"
"Little Man has a breathable atmosphere. Little Man is the right distance from a star to grow crops. God made Little Man capable of sustaining life without help from Unified Authority science. We could land a colony on Little Man this very day, and it would be self-sufficient within 3 years. Since our topic is real estate, sea soldiers, I want you to know that this naturally life-sustaining atmosphere makes Little Man a very valuable piece of property. Do you understand me, sea soldiers?"
"Sir, yes, sir!"
"And they say you leathernecks could not be taught. The only problem with Little Man is location."
The screen dissolved into a map of the galaxy, with its 6 spiral arms. A glowing red ball showed on the outermost edge of the Scutum Crux arm.
"Some of you sea soldiers may not be familiar with astronomical maps. This is a map of our galaxy. As you can see, Little Man is located on the edge of the galaxy. In real estate terms, this is not a prime location. The edge of the galaxy is called the extreme frontier. For strategic reasons, the Unified Authority has not seen fit to settle the extreme frontier. It has come to our attention that squatters have trespassed on this valuable piece of property. Your government wants these extreme frontier trespassers evicted with extreme frontier prejudice. Do you understand me, Marines?"
"Sir, yes, sir!"
The image shifted to the surface of the planet.
"This will be a land op. The enemy has established a stronghold along the west coast of this continent. That means, sea soldiers, you will launch your attack here."
The pointer landed on a long stretch of beach.
"You will establish a beachhead and force these squatters off our property. Do you understand me, Marines?"
"Sir, yes, sir!"
"Once we have broken the enemy's backbone, we will proceed through these foothills, chasing the enemy inland. You will be provided with limited air support for that part of your mission."
The map vanished from the screen and was replaced by the face of a middle-aged Japanese man with graying hair and wire-rimmed spectacles.
"This is Yoshi Yamashiro. From what Captain Olivera tells me, you sea soldiers have a score to settle with Mr. Yamashiro from Ezer Cree. For those of you with short memories, he is the man who looked the other way when one of your platoons was massacred. I may not be a Marine, but I understand that UA Marines always collect on debt. Is that correct?"
"Sir, yes, sir!"
"Sea soldiers, the Unified Authority does not care if you return with prisoners from this conflict. You are to carry out your duties with extreme prejudice. I should not have to say this to you, leathernecks, but I will. Do not hesitate to fire when fired upon. Do you understand me, Marines?"
"Sir, yes, sir!"
The briefing ended at 1800 hours. Lee and I stopped by the sea soldier's bar on the way to the barracks.
"Was I hearing things, or were we just given permission to massacre everybody on that planet?"
"That's what it sounded like to me."
"I may be mistaken, but isn't that considered a criminal act?"
"Shit, Wason, we're trying to prevent a war. Those bastards ambushed a platoon. They shot down a frigate.
If the news of this massacre gets out, we may find our citizenship officially revoked. The liberators who fought in the Galactic Central War were never allowed back into the Orion Arm for massacring prisoners on Albatross Island.
I heard that they killed the guards. And how would that news get out anyway? We're on the extreme frontier.
You're not bothered by any of this?
Nope.
Look, Lee, we're not going to do this drop in boats. If the plan is to trap and massacre the enemy, why not drop down on the land side of the foothills and chase the enemy into the sea?
They're Japanese. Maybe they're good swimmers.
You think that's funny?
Calm down. Robert Thurston planned this invasion. The guy's a friggin' genius. He kicked Kleiber's ass.
I put up my hand to quiet Lee. So many noisy Marines had come to the bar to celebrate by then that I could barely hear him anyway. But not all of the patrons were enlisted men. Captain McKay sat at a nearby table, flanked by Lecter, Saul, and Marshall.
What is it?
It's McKay. He's sitting three tables from us, with Lecter and his boys.
Risking a quick glance, I peered around Lee and noticed the stiff way McKay sat in his chair. He stared angrily at Lecter. Though all three of the new sergeants had the exact same face, I had no trouble telling them apart by their scars. Lecter had that wide gash through his left eyebrow and a long spiraling scar on his left cheek. Marshall had bald spots, probably the result of shrapnel, in his thinning white hair. Of the three, Saul might have had it the worst. The skin on his face was lumpy and blotched. He must have been burned in some kind of chemical fire.
Look at them, Wason. I'd kill myself if I were a clone.
How are you going to do it?
I would not joke about that if I were you.
Apparently, Admiral Thurston believed one ship could handle our mission. The Kamehameha was almost alone in the quadrant. The logistics were simple enough. The Kamehameha carried 15 armored transports, each of which would carry two platoons and supplies. Two trips per transport, and all 2,300 Marines would be in position. As we prepared to take our place in the kettle, I found out what Lecter and McKay were discussing in the bar. Captain McKay's command included the 12th and 13th platoons, Sergeant Grayson's. But it wasn't Grayson I saw at the head of the 13th when I led my squad into the kettle. Lecter paced the floor. Marshall and Saul sat at the stern of the ship.
Harris!
I turned and was surprised to see Captain McKay, wearing full armor with his helmet off, boarding the AT.
Coming down in the kettle, sir?
Orders. Harris, you saw that they switched Grayson out of the 13th platoon. Somebody placed all four liberators in one company. I get the feeling they want to make a clean sweep.
I get that feeling too, sir.
Watch my back, Harris. I want to survive this mission. I don't want to die on Little Man.
I will do what I can for you, sir.
We were both sergeants, but Booth Lecter outranked me. I was just a sergeant, he was a first sergeant. In the non-commissioned ranks, Lecter was just one step from the top.
Okay, so now I am nervous. What are Lecter and Saul doing on our AT? What is McKay doing here? God, I hate liberators.
They shuffled the sergeants. And, Vince, you are speaking to a liberator.
Hey, you're only a liberator in theory. Lecter's the real thing. Why would McKay trade Grayson for those three?
I don't think McKay calls the shots anymore. He looked pretty nervous at the bar last night. He must have gotten a memo about the change in platoons right after the briefing. He probably took Lecter to the bar to discuss the transfer. Remember when McKay tried to leave and Lecter stopped him? McKay must have told them how he wanted to run things and found out that Lecter and his pals had ideas of their own.
You think they threatened him?
He's staying as far from them as he can. Lecter probably said something about friendly fire or battlefield accidents.
That cuts two ways.
It should.
A yellow light flashed over the cabin, warning us that we were broaching the atmosphere. Then the amber light turned red.
What's that? They must be firing at us.
Whoever the squatters were, they had lots of firepower.
They have a particle beam cannon. Take position.
A shell struck the top of the kettle, flopping the entire AT on its side. Then the lights came back on, and within moments, we were down on the beach. The ATs landed in a row, their shields facing the bluffs at the top of the beach. The enemy's guns could not penetrate the barrier created by the shields. The melting air in front of the shields blurred my vision, but I thought I saw men scurrying along the tops of the bluffs. Two ships waddled across the sky, traveling over our heads and stopping over the enemy. There was a blinding green flash as the enemy's particle beam cannon exploded. The radioactive core of the particle beam cannon might well have irradiated the enemy. The firefight seemed to have ended. Though we did not have tanks with us, our transports brought several cavalry units with gun-mounted all-terrain vehicles. As the platoons organized behind the shields, the ATVs sped up the beach, kicking plumes of sand in their wake. We prepared to rush the bluffs.
Prepare for attack!
The shield in front of our AT extinguished. For a moment, I saw the distant hills clearly.
Attack!
We started up the beach. I kept my eye on the top of the bluffs, the enemy fortification.
Vince, do you see anything? If anybody's alive up there, they're either wearing radiation armor or they glow in the dark.
The gunships continued to float over the attack area, looking for targets. They did not fire.
Drop!
The gunships fired, but their shots were blind. The men on the ships must have been hunting human targets. Their heat sensors and radar would not locate motion-tracking drones.
It's trackers. It looks that way. Think we can go around them?
That's not worth the trouble. You watch, they're going to light up that hill.
As if on cue, the gunships fired incendiary rockets. The problem with lighting the hill was that it took 3 hours for the heat to dissipate. Until the temperature went down, the most our ground forces could do was sit. Thurston sent Harriers and bombers to patrol the other side of the foothills, but the heavily forested terrain made flybys ineffective. We'd gone to Little Man to annihilate the enemy, but for the time being, all we could do was sit tight as the enemy fled to safety. When we crested the hill, we saw the remains of a mile-long concrete bunker with yard-thick walls. With its ground cover blown to the winds, the concrete shell of the bunker lay exposed like a giant trench. The charred remains of hundreds of men covered the floor in the center of the compound. There was no way to identify the bodies. They were scorched beyond recognition. They looked mummified, with all traces of hair burned away and skin that looked like parched leather.
Think they're Japanese?
How could you possibly tell? What could these people have done to deserve this?
A few minutes later, Sergeant Lecter walked up to us.
Harris, you're on guard duty.
Aye.
I watched Lecter swagger back to the front of the platoon. Thick forest covered the foothills ahead of us. Trees with green and orange leaves, so brightly colored they looked like gigantic flowers, blanketed the countryside.
Gather up.
Once my men formed up, we started to the forest. The trees and boulders of the forest would have provided the right kind of cover for guerrilla attacks. I scanned the landscape for heat signatures, but the trunks of the trees were 10 feet in diameter. The rocks were thick and made of granite. I could not read a heat signature through such barriers. I pinged for snake shafts and found nothing, but that did little to calm my nerves. Fortunately, our scouts located enemy tracks. Hundreds of people had fled the bunkers, trampling shrubs and ferns as they rushed through the trees. Tracking the escapees posed little challenge, but the wilderness gave us other headaches. The overgrowth slowed our progress. We had to send scouts ahead on foot. 5 of our scouts did not return when we broke for camp that evening. We stopped in a mile-wide clearing that would be easy to guard. At night, Little Man cooled to a comfortable 65 degrees. When I scanned the serrated tree line with heat vision, it seemed to hold no secrets. I saw the orange signatures of forest animals moving around the trees. Every few hours, at uneven intervals, a gunship traveled around the perimeter of the clearing. At a mere 20 miles per hour, it moved with the confidence of a shark circling for food. Switching the lens in my visor to heat vision, I watched animals flee as the gunship approached. Guard duty left me with plenty of time to roll evidence over in my mind. I did not think we were there to massacre Japanese refugees from Ezer Cree. They would not have had time to build the complicated bunker system on the beach. The Morgan Atkins separatist seemed a more likely target. I did not know how the Japanese could have gotten off Ezer Cree. They never could have traveled this far. I did not know what the Mogats would want on a planet like Little Man, but I knew they had transportation. They had their own damn fleet. Still, why would the Mogats colonize a planet that was so far from civilization? As I understood it, the Mogats never populated their own planets. They sent missionaries to colonize planets and attracted converts, but there was nobody to convert in the extreme frontier. Packing quickly before sunrise, we continued through the woods. Walking in a broad column, we turned a bend and saw 2 dwarf trees with thick, low-hanging branches that crisscrossed in an arch. These trees stood no more than 40 feet tall, but the spot where their branches met was considerably lower. A wide stream of sunlight filtered in around them, bathing them with brilliant glare and shadows. 3 shadowy figures dangled from the branches like giant possums. A quick scan of the forest floor told us that the bodies were our missing scouts. Each man's armor and weapons sat in a neat pile beneath his lifeless carcass. We knew our scouts had died by hanging even before we cut their bodies down. The enemy had captured them, stripped them of their armor, and summarily executed them as war criminals. The enemy had time to leave trackers along the trail, but trackers were ineffective in such rough terrain. They also left mines and a few snipers behind. The mines were useless. We spotted them easily. The snipers, however, used effective hit-and-run tactics as they targeted our officers. We began our march with 15 majors and 3 colonels. By nightfall, 2 of the colonels and 6 of the majors were dead.
You holding up okay after that all-nighter?
Vince called over an open channel on the interlink.
But I'm asleep before anyone else tonight.
You'd lose that bet. You're on guard duty tonight.
Sergeant Lecter, you cannot send a man on guard duty 2 nights in a row.
Are you running the show now, Lee?
Back off, Vince. Wason, stay out of this.
We reached the edge of the forest in the late afternoon. There we discovered that our air support had been busy. The still unidentified squatters had built a town large enough for a few thousand residents just beyond the woods. It had paved roads and prefabricated Quonset-style buildings. Our fighters struck during the night, shredding the town. I saw shattered windows, collapsed roofs, and melted walls. What I did not see was bodies.
Fall in. Get ready. If we're going to run into more resistance on this planet, it's going to start here.
We waded toward town. Lee's squad took point, moving cautiously in a group that included a rifleman, a grenadier, and a man with an automatic rifle. They moved in slowly, pausing by fences and hiding behind overturned cars. With every step, it became clearer that the enemy had abandoned the city before our fighters attacked. The first building we passed was a 2-story cracker box with only 2 windows on its fascia. The facade was untouched, but a laser blast had melted a 10-foot chasm in a sidewall. Metal lay melted around the gaping hole like the wax bleeding from a candle. Lee and his riflemen stepped around a derelict car. They dropped back for cover and returned fire. The enemy had taken positions in the ruins of a building that might have been a latrine. McKay called over the interlink.
Harris, report. We're under fire, sir. It seems like it's just a few men hidden in a latrine. We should have the situation under control shortly.
Pockets of resistance. They're trying to slow us down. I'm getting reports of small firefights on every street. Let me know when you have the situation handled.
Aye, sir. Lee, how are you doing up there?
These guys can't shoot for shit. 20 yards away, tops.
Lecter's riflemen had flanked the enemy, slipped into the building behind them, and shot them in their hiding holes. One of the riflemen walked to a window and signaled that all was clear. His strategy was a textbook tactical advance.
Enemy contained.
I spotted a stairwell that ran below ground on the other side of the street.
Lee, take my position.
Where are you going?
I see a door that needs opening.
I peeled off from the column with 2 of my men in tow. We ran across the street and took cover behind a brick wall. The stairwell looked like it might lead to a bomb shelter or a subway station. There were no windows in the concrete walls lining the stairs, just a 7-foot iron door with an arched top. I ran down the stairs and hid by the hinged side of the door. One of my men took the other side. As I pulled the door open, he swung in, sweeping the scene with the muzzle of his rifle.
Clear.
I followed him through the door.
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
We had entered a tactical command room. File cabinets lined the walls. Several maps lay open on a table in a corner of the room. I checked the maps for traps, then leafed through the stack. The first map showed the names and locations of every military base in the Scutum Crux arm. The next map showed a complex system of dots and lines overlaying a map of the galaxy. A sidebar showed an enlarged view of the Sol system. When I saw a red circle surrounding Mars, I realized that it was a map of the broadcast network.
Don't touch anything.
We would leave it for the experts in intelligence. Captain McKay told me to nap while the rest of the men set up camp. I found a shaded corner between a tree and a stone wall. Removing my helmet, I lay on my side in the cool grass and let my mind wander. I thought about that underground map room with its diagram of the broadcast network. There was nothing top secret about the disc locations, but seeing them charted in an enemy bunker made me nervous. Those discs served as the Unified Authority's nervous system. An attack on them could bring the Republic to its knees. But why would anybody want to bring the Republic to its knees? The Senate allowed member states tremendous latitude. Breaking up UA infrastructure would end all ties of humanity that connected the various territories. Take away the unified authority, and the outer worlds would be forced to survive on their own. Night had fallen by the time Lee woke me for guard duty. He led me to the edge of town and pointed to an overturned truck.
That's your station for the night.
I took my position, hiding behind a crumpled up bumper. I had been on duty for 2 hours when Lecter came to check on me.
See anything, Harris?
No.
Keep alert.
I don't get it. What the hell did I ever do to you?
You were made, Harris. That's reason enough. Just the fact that you exist was enough to get Marshall, Saul, and me transferred to this for shit outfit.
I had nothing to do with it.
You had everything to do with it. You think this is a real mission? You think we're gonna capture this entire planet with 2,300 Marines? Is that what you think? They'd forgotten about us. Saul, Marshall, and me. Nobody in Washington knew that there were any liberators left. The brass knew about Shannon, but there was nothing anybody could do about him. Clyburn kept him nearby. Kept a watchful eye on him. Nobody could touch Shannon with Clyburn guarding him. As far as anybody knew, Shannon was the last of us. And you came along, Harris. A brand new liberator. You weren't alone, you know. Clyburn made five of you. We found the others. Marshall killed one in an orphanage. I killed three of them myself. But Clyburn hid you. Sent you to some godforsaken shithill where no one would find you. By the time I did locate you, you were already on the Kamehameha. Shut up, Harris! You asked what's bothering me, now I'm gonna tell you. And you are gonna shut your rat's ass mouth and listen, or I will shoot you. I will shoot you and say that the goddamn Japanese shot you. The government hated liberators. Congress wanted us dead. As far as anyone knew, we were all dead. Then you showed up. I heard about that early promotion and wanted to fly out and cap you on that shithill planet. I would have framed Crowley, but Clyburn transferred you before I could get there. Next thing I know, you're running missions for that asshole Huang. Shit, Huang was the reason we were hiding in the first place. As soon as I heard that you'd met Huang, I knew we were all dead. Once he got a whiff of a liberator, he would go right back to the Pentagon and try to track down every last one of us. And here we are, trying to take over a planet with 2,300 Marines. This isn't a mission, Harris. This is a cleansing. This is the last march of the liberators. And if they need to kill off 2,300 GI clones to finish us, it all works out fine on their balance sheets. Clones are expendable. You want to know what I have against you, Harris? You are the death of the liberators.
Oh.
Now watch your post. We're pushing into that valley tomorrow. Whoever we're hunting on this goddamn planet will find him in there.
Walking in squads of five, we left the town and started into the valley the next morning. There, the terrain came as something of a surprise. I expected grass, trees, and gently sloping hills. What I saw was a glacial canyon with steep, craggy walls. A well-trampled path led along the side of the canyon. The trail was wide enough for a squad or maybe a platoon, but not an entire regiment. Observing the scene from the rim of the canyon, I felt an eerie shudder of déjà vu. It was like returning to Hubble. The thick layer of fog on the canyon floor only added to the illusion. Captain McKay moved up beside me.
At least we won't need to go looking for the bastards.
Switching to heat vision, I saw what he meant. About 2 miles ahead of us, hundreds, maybe thousands of orange dots milled around the valley floor.
Look at them. Think that's what's left of the Japanese? Obviously not. Whoever they are, they're waiting for us. They're dug in tight, armed, and waiting for us. Remember when I asked you to watch my back? I know you're beat, Harris. But if you have any liberator fire left in you, get me out of this alive.
Yes, sir.
Our assault took place in three stages. As the sun rose over the far edge of the canyon, we assembled. Our officers, the few who had survived the previous day's snipers, surveyed the field and assigned routes to each platoon. Then we fell into formation and made our last preparations. A wide river must have once run across the valley. Its long, smooth, fossilized trail offered excellent placement for men with mortars. Having left the artillery behind, we divided into two groups. The majority of the men formed a column that would attack the squatters head-on. One lone platoon would be assigned to move along the south side of the canyon and attempt to flank the enemy.
Harris, your platoon is covering the flank.
Who signed us up for that?
Lecter recommended you. He's pretty much running this show. Everybody's afraid of him.
Are you coming with us?
No.
With that, McKay signed off. Then, the 2,000-man column started forward. Our artillery units began lobbing mortars. The enemy had the tactical advantage of choosing the field, but our artillery soon battered their positions. Hidden by a slope in the terrain, we slipped forward undetected. As we closed in, I hid behind some sagebrush and spied on the enemy position. The main column remained just out of range as the bombardment continued. Before we could attack, the squatters retreated. They abandoned their position and ran. I watched them from behind a sagebrush blind. Thousands of men running toward distant canyon walls. I thought they were running from our mortars, but that wasn't the case. Far overhead, another battle was taking place. Robert Thurston, the master tactician, had lied to us about everything. These squatters were Mogat separatists. And while Little Man was not exactly Morgan Atkins' mecca, the planet was a separatist stronghold. Giving us bad intelligence, Thurston landed our forces by the Mogat's weakest flank. With minimal air support and the element of surprise, we broke their defenses and chased their unprepared army. But reinforcements would soon arrive. Admiral Thurston, who viewed clones as equipment of no more value than bullets or tank treads, used us as bait to lure the separatists into a counterattack. As we chased Mogats on the surface of Little Man, four self-broadcasting battleships appeared around the Kamehameha. Thurston barely managed to raise his shields before they opened fire. With the dreadnoughts battering her shields, the Kamehameha headed toward a nearby moon. The army that joined the Mogats at the far end of the canyon outnumbered us 5-1. Their tanks and jeeps were 40 years old. The army wore red armor. Red, not camouflaged, so no attempt was made to blend in. They poured down the rim of the canyon like fire ants rushing out of an anthill. Our officers were alert. The column quickly collapsed into a defensive perimeter by taking shelter behind the side of the riverbed.
Holy shit. When are you down there?
Hold your position, Lee. Captain McKay, I'm coming to get you out of there.
The Mogats were at the bottom of the canyon and coming fast.
Do they see your position?
I doubt it.
Get your men out of here, Harris.
From where I lay, about 300 yards from the action, the battle seemed to take place in miniature. The enemy looked poorly trained, but that would not matter with their numerical advantage. The Mogat gunners figured out the range, and their shells began pounding the riverbed. Back behind the brunt, our light artillery returned fire far more effectively, hitting the advancing sea of enemy soldiers time and again. It didn't matter. There were far too many of them for a few shells to matter. Squads of fighters and six destroyers raced to the Kamehameha's aid. In the distance, the Washington and the Grant, ironically the two ships Thurston used to defeat Bryce Kleiber in their simulated battle, remained stationed behind the cover of the distant moon. Thurston's ships counterattacked swiftly. Before the battleships could broadcast themselves to safety, Thurston's Tomcats and Phantoms swarmed them. His destroyers arrived moments later, blasting the battleships with cannons that disrupted their shields. The Mogats had enormous ships, but their technology was 40 years old. The surprise attack succeeded. Two of the battleships exploded before returning fire. The third staged a weak defense, managing to demolish several fighters and dent one destroyer before exploding. The last Mogat battleship turned and ran. Closing in from the rear, a destroyer fired several shots at the battleship's aft engine area. The ship's rear shields failed, and several of its engines exploded just as it entered Little Man's atmosphere. The Mogats poured into the valley like a tidal wave.
What do we do?
McKay ordered me to retreat.
Without a word, my men turned and started back. Then Lee noticed that I did not follow.
Harris, what are you doing?
I want to get McKay out of there. I promised I would watch his back.
Wason, you've got to be joking. Take another look. He's probably dead by now.
I crawled up for one last look. The Mogats had closed in around our front line and overwhelmed it. In the center of the battle, the Marines put on one hell of a show. Our riflemen pinned down pockets of enemy Mogat soldiers, and our artillerymen lobbed a continuous arc of mortar fire. Despite their efforts, there was no denying the superiority of numbers.
Can we go now?
Okay, Marines, let's move quickly!
By the time we reached the far end of the valley floor, the battle was winding down. By then, we were several hundred yards from the battlefield. If we could just reach the top of the ridge without being seen.
Stay low. Move fast. Any questions?
I led the way, rifle drawn, shoulders hunched, running as fast as I could. The path started at a gentle angle, no more than 10 degrees. A few yards up, however, it took a steep turn. I felt fire in my calves. Turning a bend in the path, I paused and saw four trails of dust streaking along the valley floor in our direction.
Move it! They're coming! Move it! Move it! Move it!
The ATVs stopped a few yards from the base of the trail. As the last of my men ran past me, I saw four men climbing off their vehicles. They had rifles slung over their shoulders. One of my men went down in a spray of gore. Next thing I knew, Smith fell dead. The men at the base of the trail never missed a shot.
Everybody down! Snipers!
Across the valley, hundreds of soldiers were headed in our direction. If we did not get up the ridge quickly, we would never make it up at all.
Lee, take them up the hill.
What are you doing? That is an order, Corporal!
Below me, one of the snipers saw Lee get to his feet. He swung his rifle. As he trained on the target, I took aim. I crawled along the ground, steadied my rifle, and rolled to one knee. In the background, I saw the Mogat army. They were almost here. Ducking out of their sight, I lobbed a grenade. I rolled onto my back and saw a dark gray triangle dropping quickly through the sky. It looked like a capital ship, but capital ships were not designed to fly in atmospheric conditions. As the ship flew closer, I noticed that there were dozens of smaller ships buzzing around it. The ship was dropping lower and lower. The fighters that surrounded the ship continued to pick at it with lasers and rockets.
Harris, get out of there! The thing is gonna crash!
Flames burst out the front and rear of the ship as it dropped like a shooting star. The battleship slammed into the far end of the valley. The audio equipment in my helmet had gone dead. Below me, the canyon was consumed with molten fire. The battleship had skidded across the canyon, cutting a deep gash and spewing fiery fuel and radioactive debris in every direction. As I reached the top of the trail, Lee and another man grabbed my arms. My legs locked and I started to fall, but they held me up. I could tell that they were trying to speak to me, but I heard nothing through my dead audio equipment. Lee and the private lowered me to the ground. I fell on my back and stared into the sky. Above me, a UA Phantom fighter circled in triumph. An entire regiment had been demolished. But for Robert Thurston, Little Man was a triumph indeed. Of the 2,300 men sent down to Little Man, only 7 survived. There were no wounded. That was the reality, and I kept on realizing it again and again. The battle on Little Man lit a fire in the public's imagination. The new Little Bighorn said the Unified Authority Broadcasting Company, UABC, headlines. Other famous massacres were also invoked. The Pentagon served up an endless supply of details about the battle, milking it for every drop of public support. A briefing officer held a meeting in which he traced our movements using maps. The Public Affairs Office released photographs of the captured map room. The Joint Chiefs gave the UABC profiles and photographs of the 100 officers who died during the assault. Captain Galen McKay, a promising officer in life, became a public figure in death. The Pentagon did not release information about survivors, but somehow the press got wind of us. We were dubbed the Little Man 7. Probably hoping that the story would go away, the Joint Chiefs acknowledged only that a fast-thinking sergeant had managed to evacuate 6 men from the field. They did not release my name. I did not care. As time went by, Lee returned to his weight training, and I became obsessed with marksmanship. I practiced with automatic rifles, grenade launchers, and sniper rifles, shooting round after round. Lee and I went to the crewman's bar almost every night. Having spent a month and a half hoping for the public to forget about the Little Man 7, Washington finally embraced us. In his capacity as the Secretary of the Navy, Admiral Huang announced plans to bootstrap us to officer status. The thought of promoting a liberator must have caused him great pain. Lee and the other men were transferred to officer training school in Australia. I was called to appear before the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. The night before Lee and the others left for OTS, we all went to the crewman's bar for one last gathering. We found that news of our transfers had spread throughout the ship. As we entered the bar, some sailors called us to join them.
Officers! If someone would have told me that all I had to do was survive a massacre and a crash to become an officer, I'd have done it 5 years ago.
Lee and the others are shipping out tomorrow.
Congratulations.
One of the sailors reached over and shook Lee's hand.
I better do this now. Next time I may have to salute you pricks. When are you leaving, Harris?
Not for a couple of days.
I can't believe they're shipping all you out. I guess Oliveira needs to make room, doesn't he?
Make room for what?
Seals. Squads of them. Hundreds of them.
Lee and I looked at each other. This was the first time we had heard about seals. Until we received our transfers, we'd both expected to remain on the Kamehameha to train new Marines.
That's the scuttlebutt. I'm surprised you never heard it.
Did you know that Harris is going to Washington?
We all heard about the medal. Everybody knows it. You're the pride of the ship.
A medal?
You know more about it than we do.
Harris, why else would you appear before Congress?
As a guest of the House of Representatives, I expected to travel in style. When I reached the hangar, I found the standard-issue military transport. Huge, noisy, and built to carry 60 highly uncomfortable passengers. The Kamehameha was still orbiting Little Man. We were 9 miserable days from the nearest broadcast discs. Feeling dejected, I trudged up the ramp to the transport. After stowing my bags in a locker, I settled into the seat that would be my home for the next 9 days. As I waited for takeoff, someone slid into the seat next to mine.
Sergeant Harris, I presume.
I am?
I'm Nesta Smart, Sergeant. I've been assigned to accompany you to Washington.
All the way to Washington?
They're not going to jettison me in space, Harris.
Nesta Smart. Nesta Smart? I had heard that name before. I turned and recognized the face.
Aren't you the governor of Ezra Cree?
I was the interim governor. A new governor has been elected. I was just there as a troubleshooter.
I see.
We have 10 days, Sergeant. It isn't nearly enough time, but we will have to make do. You've got a lot to learn before we can present you to the House.
The shuttle lifted off the launch pad. Watching the Kamehameha shrink into space, I knew Smart was right. I was an enlisted Marine. What did I know about politics? I turned and looked a real look at the man and realized that he was several inches taller than I. An athletic-looking man with squared shoulders and a rugged jaw, he looked more like a soldier than a pencil pusher.
Now that I have your attention, perhaps we can discuss your visit to the Capitol. You may not be aware of it, but several congressmen protested our actions on Little Man. There's been a lot of infighting between the House and the Senate lately.
Do you mean things like Congress passing a bill to cut military spending?
You've heard about that.
And the Senate calling for more orphanages?
Bravo! A soldier who reads the news. What will they come up with next?
I'm a Marine.
Yes, I know that.
I'm not a soldier. Do you call Navy personnel soldiers?
They're sailors.
And I am a Marine.
A Marine who follows the news.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, we Marines can't spend our entire lives shooting people and breaking things.
You'll find that I do not have much of a sense of humor, Sergeant. I don't make jokes during the best of times, and this is not my idea of the best of times. To be honest with you, I don't approve of Marines speaking on Capitol Hill.
Whose idea was it?
You're considered a hero, Sergeant Harris. Everybody loves a hero, especially in politics. But not everybody loves you. There are congressmen who will try to twist your testimony to further their own political agendas.
The congressman from Ezra Cree?
James Smith? He's the least of your worries. The last representative from Ezra Cree disappeared with Yamashiro. Smith is an appointee. If you run into trouble, it's going to come from somebody like Gordon Hughes.
From Olympus Cree?
Very good. The representative from Olympus Cree. He will not take you head on. You're one of the Little Man's 7. Picking a fight with you would not be politic. He might try to make the invasion look like the first hostile action in an undeclared war. The question is how he can make Little Man look illegal without openly attacking you.
Will you be there when I go before the House?
Harris, I'm not letting you out of my sight until you leave Washington. That is a promise. Do you know your way around Washington, D.C.?
The capital of the Unified Authority lay spread under a clear afternoon sky. With its rows of gleaming white marble buildings, the city simply looked perfect.
I've never been here before.
Our transport began its approach, flying low over a row of skyscrapers. I saw people standing on balconies. Off in the distance, I saw the Capitol, an immense marble building with a 300-foot dome of white marble.
The Capitol.
Good, Harris. You know your landmarks.
A highly manicured mall with gleaming walkways and marble fountains stretched between the White House and the Capitol. Thousands of people, tourists, bureaucrats, and politicians walked that mall. From our transport, they looked like dust mites swirling in a shaft of light.
I can barely wait to go out and explore the city.
You're going to spend a quiet evening locked away in Navy housing. We cannot afford for you to show up tomorrow with a hangover.
Our transport began its vertical descent to a landing pad. Smart slipped out of his chair and pulled his jacket off a hanger. Reaching for the inside breast pocket of the coat, he pulled a business card out and wrote a note on the back of it. After giving it a quick read, he handed it to me.
There's a driver waiting outside. He will take you to the Navy base. Show this card to the guard at the gate. Also, your promotion is now official. Befitting your war hero status, you are now a lieutenant in the Unified Authority Marines. You will find your new wardrobe in the apartment. I suppose congratulations are in order, Lieutenant Harris.
The White House had guest rooms, but I was not invited to stay in those hallowed halls. A driver dropped me at the barracks door. Carrying my rucksack over my shoulder, I found my room. The lock was programmed to recognize my ID card. I stepped into a room with a single bed. The room had a closet, a dresser, and a bathroom. Smiling and feeling slightly ashamed, I placed my ruck down, walked around the room, turning on a lamp here, dragging my finger across the desk there, and allowing water to run from a faucet. I took a shower and shaved. 9 days of travel had left my blouse badly wrinkled, but it was an enlisted man's blouse. In the closet, I found a uniform with the small gold bar of a second lieutenant on the shoulder. I dressed as an officer and left to meet the base commander. When I arrived at his office, his secretary went into his office to notify him I was there. The captain emerged a moment later with several officers.
Lieutenant Harris?
Sir.
I saluted him. The entire company broke into huge, toothy smiles.
Oh, pleasure to meet you, Lieutenant. I'm Jeffrey Baxter. Do you have a moment? Are you meeting with anyone this evening?
No.
Baxter led me into a large office, and we sat in a row of chairs. As the receptionist brought us drinks, the officers crowded around me, and more officers strayed into the room.
I'm not sure that I understand. Were you expecting me?
Expecting you? We've been waiting for you. Harris, you're famous around here. Your photograph is all over the media link.
My photograph? How about my men?
They're clones, aren't they? Everybody knows what they look like. Have you had dinner yet?
I was going to ask for directions to the officers' mess.
No mess hall food for you. Not tonight. Not for you. I know you've just arrived, but are you up for a night out?
We did not get home until long after midnight. I did not get to bed until well after 0200. I'm not making excuses, but I am explaining why I did not arrive at the House of Representatives in satisfactory condition. Sleep-addled and mildly buzzed from a long night of drinking, I found myself leaning against the wall of the elevator for support as I rode up to meet Nestor Smart.
What the hell happened to you?
I'm just a little tired. I had a late night out with some officers from the base.
Imbecile! You are supposed to appear before the House in 2 hours, and you look like you just fell out of bed!
You mind keeping your voice down?
Smart led me down Liberty Boulevard, a wide hallway with royal blue carpeting and a mural of 17th century battle scenes painted onto a rounded ceiling. Shafts of sunlight lanced down from those windows.
This is an amazing city. It must be old hat for you.
You never get used to it, Harris. That's the intoxicating thing about life in Washington. You never get used to it.
As we turned off to a less spectacular corridor, Smart pointed to a two-paneled door.
Do you know what that is?
No.
That, Harris, is the lion's den. That is the chamber. Behind those doors are 1,026 congressmen. Some of them want to make you a hero. Some of them will use you to attack the military. None of them, Lieutenant, are your friends. The first rule of survival in Washington, D.C. is that you have no friends. You may have allies, but you do not have friends.
That's bleak. I think I prefer military combat.
This is the only battlefield that matters, Lieutenant. Nothing you do out there matters. Everything permanent is done in this building. Remember, Harris, these people are looking for ammunition. Answer questions as briefly as possible. You have no friends in the House of Representatives. If a congressman is friendly, it's only because he wants to look good for the voters back home.
The door to the chamber opened, and three pages came to meet us. They were mere kids, college age, my age, and possibly a few years older, but raised rich and inexperienced. They had never seen death, and probably never would.
Governor Smart, did you accomplish what you wanted on Ezra Cree?
Smart nodded curtly, but did not speak.
And you must be Lieutenant Harris. Good of you to come, Lieutenant. Why don't you gentlemen follow me?
The page turned to lead us into the house.
Tommy Guileman. He's Gordon Hughes' top aide.
The House of Representatives' chambers looked something like a church. The floor was divided into two wide sections. The pages led us down the center aisle. At the far end of the floor, I saw a dais. On it were two desks, one for Gordon Hughes, Speaker of the House, and one for Arnold Lund, the leader of the loyal opposition. I took my place at a pulpit between them and thought of Jesus Christ being crucified between two thieves. Below me, the house spread out in a vast sea of desks, politicians, and bureaucrats. Fortunately, I was not alone. Nestor Smart hovered right beside me. Speaker Hughes stepped up to his microphone.
Members of the House of Representatives, it is my pleasure to present Lieutenant Wason Harris of the Unified Authority Marine Corps. As you know, Lieutenant Harris is a survivor of the battle at Little Man. Do you have prepared remarks?
No, sir.
Quite understandable. Perhaps we should open this session to the floor. I am sure many members have questions for you.
The leader of the loyal opposition moved to a microphone.
If there are no objections, I would like to open with a few questions.
The chair recognizes Representative Arnold Lund.
Lieutenant, members of the House, as you know, the Republic has entered dark times in which separatist factions have challenged our government.
He's on our side. He's signaling us and his allies how to play this. He will try to shield you if the questions get hostile.
As we all know, a landing force was sent to Little Man for peaceful purposes. More than 2,000 Marines were brutally butchered. I am certain that history will show that these men died bravely.
The leader of the loyal opposition showed no signs of slowing as his speech passed the 7-minute mark.
Were it possible, we should erect a statue for every victim of that Holocaust.
Lund waxed on and on about the innocence of our 2,300-man, highly armed landing party and the brutality of the MOGAT response. He talked about the unprovoked attack on the Kamehameha and the good fortune that other ships happened to be nearby.
Lieutenant Wason Harris is one of only 7 men who survived that unprovoked attack. Fellow representatives, I would personally like to thank Lieutenant Harris for his valor.
The floor now recognizes the junior representative from Olympus Cree.
An old woman with crinkled salt and pepper hair pulled back in a tight bun stood.
Olympus Cree celebrates your safe return from Little Man, Lieutenant Harris. I am sure the battle must have been a very grueling experience. What can you tell us about the nature of the incursion on Little Man?
The nature?
What was the reason you went down to Little Man?
Remember, you're an ignorant foot soldier.
Why did I go to Little Man, ma'am? We went because that was where the transport dropped us off.
I see. Well, Lieutenant, as I understand it, there were 2,300 Marines on Little Man. That sounds like quite an invasion. Is it?
Excuse me?
Why did you invade Little Man?
I was not involved in the planning of this mission, ma'am.
2,300 units? What reason were you given for sending so many men to the planet?
Ma'am, I was a sergeant. Nobody gives sergeants reasons. They just tell us what to do.
I see.
Nestor Smart leaned over to whisper something to me.
Did you have something to add, Mr. Smart?
I was just advising Lieutenant Harris about the kind of information you might be looking for.
From your vast store of battlefield experience, Mr. Smart? Lieutenant, I am merely trying to determine why so many Marines were sent to the surface of Little Man. I am not asking for an official explanation. You are a soldier in the Unified Authority Marine Corps. Surely you have some understanding about how things are done.
It's not unusual for ships to send their complements of Marines to a planet, ma'am.
2,000 men? That sounds more like an occupying force.
Ma'am, 2,300 men with light arms is a tiny force. We keep more men than that on most friendly planets.
I see. Lieutenant Harris, I thank you for your service to the Republic.
I recognized the next senator's face from countless Media Link stories. Tall, with dark skin and a beard that looked like a chocolate smudge around his mouth, this was Congressman Bill Hawkins, who represented a group of small planets in the Sagittarius arm.
Lieutenant Harris, I salute you for your service to our fine republic. Lieutenant, perhaps I can assist my esteemed colleague from Olympus Cree.
Perhaps my esteemed colleague has not noticed that the lieutenant has already answered her questions.
Certain questions remain unanswered.
Representative Lund, Representative Hawkins has the floor. Please allow him to continue.
And I do congratulate the lieutenant. Well done, Lieutenant Harris. But in light of new information, certain questions must be answered.
What information is that?
Oh, yes. Nestor Smart. Good of you to escort the lieutenant. After surviving a brutal battle on Little Man, it would be a shame if this fine Marine was lost in a dangerous place like the House of Representatives.
Order! Order! What new information have you acquired, Senator Hawkins?
Hawkins reached down and pulled a combat helmet out from beneath his desk.
Do you recognize this, Lieutenant?
That is a combat helmet.
Your combat helmet, Lieutenant. One of my aides retrieved it from a repair shop on the Kamehameha. It appears that its audio sensors failed during the battle. We downloaded the data recorded in the memory chip of this helmet. The data shows that you acted most heroically, Lieutenant Harris.
Thank you, Senator.
Your mission, however, was about more than squatters. Congressman Hughes, with your permission, I would like to show the chamber some excerpts from Lieutenant Harris's record.
Acceptable, Mr. Speaker. This is a blindside attack.
Ironic. That is the exact accusation I have against the men who planned the invasion of Little Man. We can view this record in a special committee if that is what my esteemed colleague wishes, but a committee investigation would require the testimony of all the men who survived this attack. We would need them to verify that the records have not been altered. Today, we have the benefit of Lieutenant Harris's expertise. I think we should view his record while he is here and able to comment on it. If you like, Mr. Speaker, we can put it up to a vote.
There is no need to hold a vote. I will allow you to show your information.
A large screen dropped from the ceiling behind the dais.
Do you recognize this scene, Lieutenant?
Yes. I was on guard duty the night before the battle.
The ghost of First Sergeant Booth Lecter came walking through the undergrowth.
So the battle was the very next morning?
Yes, sir.
I don't get it. What the hell did I ever do to you?
You were made, Harris. That's reason enough. Just the fact that you exist was enough to get Marshal Saul and me transferred to this for shit outfit.
The video feed paused.
Who is this man?
Master Sergeant Booth Lecter.
I know that, Lieutenant. I can read his identifier on the screen. I am asking about his relationship with you. What did he mean when he said that he was transferred because you exist? Why don't you think about that question as we watch more of this video feed?
I had nothing to do with it.
You had everything to do with it. You think this is a real mission? You think we're going to capture this entire planet with 2,300 Marines? Is that what you think? They'd forgotten about us. Saul, Marshall, and me. Nobody in Washington knew that there were any liberators left. The brass knew about Shannon, but there was nothing anybody could do about him. Clyburn kept him nearby. Kept a watchful eye on him. Nobody could touch Shannon with Clyburn guarding him. As far as anybody knew, Shannon was the last of us. And you came along, Harris. A brand new liberator. You weren't alone, you know. Clyburn made five of you. We found the others. Marshall killed one in an orphanage. I killed three of them myself. But Clyburn hid you. Sent you to some godforsaken shithill where no one would find you. By the time I did locate you, you were already on the Kamehameha. Shut up, Harris. You asked what's bothering me. Now I'm gonna tell you. And you are gonna shut your rat's ass mouth and listen, or I will shoot you. I will shoot you and say that the goddamn Japanese shot you. The government hated liberators. Congress wanted us dead. As far as anyone knew, we were all dead. Then you showed up. I heard about that early promotion and wanted to fly out and cap you you on that shithill planet. I would have framed Crowley, but Cliver transferred you before I could get there. Next thing I know, you're running missions for that asshole Huang. Shit, Huang was the reason we were hiding in the first place. As soon as I heard that you'd met Huang, I knew we were all dead. Once he got a whiff of a Liberator, he would go right back to the Pentagon and try to track down every last one of us. And here we are, trying to take over a planet with 2,300 Marines. This isn't a mission, Harris. This is a cleansing. This is the last march of the Liberators, and if they need to kill off 2,300 GI clones to finish us, it all works out fine on their balance sheets. Clones are expendable. You want to know what I have against you, Harris? You are the death of the Liberators.
I was a young boy during the days of the Galactic Central War, Lieutenant. I toured the devastation of both New Prague and Dallas Prime shortly after graduating OTS. Lieutenant Harris, I have seen the destruction that Liberators do. Are you a Liberator?
Perhaps you have forgotten the mission of this body, Congressman.
I recognized that voice at once, but turned to check. Admiral Bryce Cliber stood alone at the far end of the floor.
The mission of this body is to represent the people. When representatives take it upon themselves to exceed their mission, they endanger the institution itself. And now, Congressman Hughes, if there are no more questions, I suggest you propose a motion to recognize Lieutenant Harris's gallant service and dismiss him.
With Admiral Cliber watching, Hughes took an open vote. Across the floor, Bill Hawkins's delegation exited the chamber. 10 minutes later, when Hughes tallied the vote, he noted that Hawkins abstained. The rest of the House, even the representatives from Olympus Cree, voted for my commendation.